Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
McDonald County, Missouri. A woman and her husband find the remains of a woman near an abandoned house. She's been bound, her hands and legs tied behind her back. With no identification on her and no one coming forward to claim her, she becomes one of America's unidentified women and is given the name Grace Doe. It is only through the grace of God that her identity will be returned to her. And for 30 years, that's true. Until one day, science gives her her name back. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes By Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we will be joined by guest reader Terrell Rothery.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
It's been a tough couple of episodes, so I just wanted to check in to see how you're doing.
That's your question? You just put it all on me. I didn't have time to think that through. Wow. Damn it. Oh, now give me a minute. Well, that's kind of tough to say, Amy, because to be fair, they're all tough episodes on one level or another. Yes, the last two have been particularly hard. But I think it in a way, it's making me feel like talking about these things is the right thing to do. Like, we need to let people be kind of aware of what's happening, but also remember some of these victims. Because, like, with the torso murders, last week's episode, everybody was almost just reduced to a number. And so talking about those people and trying to remember what we can about them and their lives and that they had lives aside from what happened to them, I think is our ultimate goal, right?
Right. And, you know, I think that's often lost, particularly when we're entering like the true crime space. And so this episode that we're talking about today, I'm going to be trying to be as sensitive as possible because there's some actually controversial developments in the case that we'll talk about. And there's some, you know, positive developments in the case in terms of learning more about the person and what happened, and kind of like some directions that it's going that, you know, have caused some conflict. So for this story, we're going straight into rural Missouri, what I would say would be the southwestern corner of the state. Now, normally when I have addresses or even road names for these stories, I'll drive around and Google Street View if it's not a place I've physically been before. For us, at least, this story starts on the Oscar Talley Road, which is described as a narrow, winding rural road between Pineville, Missouri and Lanigan, Missouri. And so I got ready to situate myself in this area courtesy of Google, but it's so rural that even Google was like, no, no, nope. And it's not on Street View at all.
Okay, so we're going that rural today.
Yeah.
Which is usually like not always the best thing.
Right. Well, yeah.
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 In this case, it won't be.
It won't be. No. So even though this is like relatively close to US 71, like really, like this is a corner of the state that's definitely more rural, which I say this as, you know, both of us live in a rural area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And look at me saying the word rural multiple times.
And it's such an awkward word.
It is.
Rural. Like, it kind of makes you feel like mush mouthed every time you say it.
Exactly. I used to live off Rural Road in
So you had Tempe, to say it constantly.
So I had to say it constantly. And oh my God, it was like one of my words, like hydrangea.
Yeah. And I think kind of coming from rural area, you kind of see that like people are always so worried about what can happen in cities. Things can happen where there are like where there's an absence of population as well.
Right.
In like a much quieter way sometimes. So
yeah, actually, you know, I used to work at a university and a lot of our students came from New York City and they said how much more frightened they were being up here where it's so dark and so quiet and nobody's around.
It can be creepy and unsettling.
Yeah. So to begin this story, A woman named Linda Groller, she lived on this road, the Oscar Tally Road. And on December 2nd, 1990, Linda Groller and her husband decided to take a walk after church and pick up trash along the way. As they approached a farmhouse that had been abandoned for at least 4 years, the husband spots a skull. And nearby, they see the rest of a body. So they get out of there and they immediately make it to a phone to call the McDonald County Sheriff's Department.
Like the equivalent, like, of a dog finding it, but with humans.
Yeah.
That are helping, trying to help.
I know.
The environment.
Right. So, like, they're out there trying to do good. And, I mean, it is good that they found her.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. What police find when they arrive had to really have been a shocking scene. The woman's head was detached, but that appeared to have been from animal activity. Her head, though, had been covered in rags that were secured around her neck with a piece of coaxial cable. And for those of you who don't know or who need to double check what coaxial cable for, it's primarily used in cable and television communications.
It's funny because I don't know much about technology, like as far as the cables go. And I actually knew what that one was. So
I was like, I need to confirm.
Yeah, I'm glad.
So the woman's remains were decomposed. She was wearing readily identifiable clothing, including Lee brand jeans, a white t-shirt, and blue jean jacket. She had on white fitness brand high top shoes in a size 7.5. For the most part, though, all of those items are relatively commonplace and they weren't necessarily distinctive in any way. But what is distinctive about how she's found is that she is tied up. Some specifically describe this as her being hogtied, which would mean that her wrists and ankles were bound and then tied together behind her back. Don't Google that word.
Oh gosh, do you get like illustrations?
Well, my safe search was like, no ma'am.
Oh, okay.
No ma'am.
It didn't let you. Good. Yeah.
And she was restrained with 6 different types of materials. In addition to the cables, whoever did this to her used nylon and lead ropes, telephone cables, paracord, and some clothesline. The most significant of these is perhaps the paracord. Paracord is usually relatively lightweight rope that has like a nylon casing and several strands running through it. What was unique about this particular paracord was that it was a military grade MILC 5040H type 2 paracord, which apparently was sold exclusively to the military in the 1990s.
So most likely, would you say that we're looking at someone who either is in the military or has access to military supplies?
Yeah, that's definitely the angle I think they were going with this. So this is just not like some usual consumer grade cord that was used.
They also used an excessive amount of kinds of cord.
Yes, all these different types.
What did he think when he was tying up?
Yeah, this is a lot.
This is too much. Well, come on, pick one. You may continue.
She had no identification on her, but they're able to determine that she's a white woman, likely between 5'1 and 5'4, and that she's likely in her mid to late 20s. They determined that she had been sexually assaulted and that this was, of course, a homicide. They also estimate that her death likely happened 2 months before, so that would be in October of 1990. A boy and his family who lived nearby came forward within days of this being in the news. They say that the boy had told his parents he had seen a body as early as November 3rd, but he had been unable to convince his parents of what he saw. After, of course, the discovery of her body, they found out he had been telling the truth.
Seriously?
Yeah.
This kid had been telling his parents and they were just like, no.
Yeah, they thought he was making this up.
Believe your children.
So this is like, you know, she's not found for nearly a month later.
Oh my goodness.
And so when something like this happens, investigators are working to solve 2 things, of course. First, who the person is, and second, who murdered them. And often it'll be seen in some of the other stories we've shared, the second part of who murdered them really stalls out because 2 of the primary tactics used to do this is to trace someone's steps in the time leading up to the murder and to talk to people they know or are associated with.
Both of which we
can't do.
We don't have.
And that's really the story there. They need to start with who she is because there's not a lot of other clues. Now, there are some missing persons in the region. Investigators reach out to the police in Springfield, Missouri, where they have a list of 15 missing women at the time. Of these 15, they think three might be possibilities, but they actually rule these three out. One is a 19-year-old whose friends and family are kind of evasive about answering questions. The second woman is in her 30s who seemed to be hiding out to keep family services from taking her child. And the third is a pregnant woman who left with her young child. And then, likely because of all of this news about this woman being found, a relative of a fourth woman calls and says that the clothing of their missing loved one sounds similar to those this woman wore. Unfortunately, none of those proved to be viable leads.
That's a lot. There's 15 missing women in this area?
Mm-hmm. That's in Springfield, Missouri, which is a bit away. But yeah, it's kind of like the next major stop, you would say. Their next angle was to see if they could connect this woman to the murder of Connie Zaleski. Connie was a 31-year-old woman who had been missing for 13 hours on October 14th of this year. So the same month that this woman, you know, the unidentified woman in McDonald County was murdered. She was last seen in Desloge, Missouri. Her body was found later that day by a group of men who had stopped at a rest stop. She was found on the bank of the Big River in Leadwood. That's only about 4 hours away from where the unidentified woman was found.
So was she also bound up in the same way?
Well, what they discovered is that Connie was likely strangled to death as well. And though there was no cord or rope found with her body, it appears that maybe some type of clothesline or cord had been wrapped around her neck. She had also been sexually assaulted. And so a lot of those details, they really do seem to be similar, but investigators couldn't find anything definitive linking them. And in any case, Connie's case was also an unsolved homicide. So they're really left with very few leads. The unidentified woman is sent to Columbia, Missouri, to the University of Missouri Medical Center, where they try to get what they can to identify her. There's hope that her extensive dental work will be a key, but again, that doesn't go anywhere. And then this is where things really start to slow down. There's very little information they have about her, few leads, but that doesn't mean she was forgotten about. Lieutenant Mike Hall, who was working as the McDonald County Deputy Sheriff, and he said he was working her case for about 14 years, hoping to find out who she was and who her killer might be. He said to reporters, "If I'm driving around, out on patrol, my mind would sometimes wander. I think about who brought her out here. It's always on my mind."
I mean, it's got to be a lot when somebody's, it's his work, but it's like so linked to like this, you know how bothered you are when you just like can't like remember a name or do something simple, but he's like actually trying to find like a whole identity here for somebody. So it's got to be bothersome. Like what is he missing? What is he not seeing, or what information is out there? It's, I could see that like weighing really heavily on someone.
Yeah. And you know, I'm sort of obsessive by nature, and so yeah, that's not something I could ever leave alone, and it sounds like this is just something he kept returning to time and again. So then this is around 2008. McDonald County Sheriff's Detective Lori Howard enters the scene. Lori Howard just so happened to have a desk near Linda Groller, who was a deputy sheriff. Now, to remind everyone, it's actually Linda Groller and her husband who found the unidentified woman in 1990. Lori Howard says that Linda would occasionally mention the unidentified woman, which is not surprising since at this point she was the only unsolved murder in the county. So eventually, Lori pulled up a chair and basically asked Linda to tell her what she knew. And this moment, the storytelling sends Lori on a quest. Basically, on her own time, she starts digging into this case. She reads the reports, she talks to investigators who are there, she starts looking at the physical evidence from the case that's still being held in storage. She looks at the woman's clothing, the bindings that were used on her. There's actually this really striking image of Lori that we'll share out on our social pages that shows Lori photographed with those bindings, and it really gives an entirely different perspective on just the amount of bindings that were used on this woman, like, as you were mentioning.
It's a little intense.
It's intense. And just to see, like, not only the different types, but, like, the amount of those types. During this time of Lori's investigations, one of Lori's friends tells her that the only way this unidentified woman is going to be identified is through the grace of God. And so Lori and the other investigators start referring to the unidentified woman as Grace Doe. This is also what she becomes known as in the media and in online forums for people trying to solve these unsolved cases.
One thing that I'm like, we talked about at the beginning how like none of these stories are very great. But one thing I'm really liking about this one is how invested everyone is in trying to get this woman back her identity. And that's not usually the case when we're having discussions about unidentified women or unidentified people in general. So it is kind of nice to see how much these people care.
Yeah, I mean, I was just watching a press conference yesterday about a missing person. She'd been missing for like 70 something years. And this investigator who just continued on and on trying to find out where she was for her family. And so you get investigators like that, or investigators like Lori, who they are determined and they're going to figure this out. And that's heartwarming. On the other side, we do often hear of other cases where they're like not as invested in figuring out these crimes.
Yeah, definitely.
So while she's on her quest, Lori decides that one of the primary ways she's going to get Grace Doe identified is by having a rendering done so that the McDonald County can have an image that they can share out to people. Lori told reporters, "I knew I needed to put a face on her. I knew I needed to put a face on Grace." Unfortunately, there is a major problem with Lori's plans, and that is that even though quite a bit of evidence from the case was held in evidence storage, one thing that was not there that should have been the remains of Grace Doe.
Where is she?
They have no idea.
She's been misplaced?
She has been misplaced, and no one knows exactly where she might be.
Yeah, okay.
Uh-huh. And Lori needs this because one of the common ways to do a reconstruction is to send the skull or have scans done of the skull and sent to the reconstruction artist.
I can imagine how much Lori was bothered by this.
Yeah.
Like, how horrible.
Yeah. But, you know, like, I think the thing about her that I just, like, love so much is, like, she is so determined, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so she thought, she kept on saying to herself, apparently, I will find you. I will find out who you are. I won't stop until I do. And so she contacted Victoria Lywood, who did reconstructions and was associated with the anthropology department at John Abbott College in Quebec. They decided that Lori would send what she could, which at that point were just photos. Eventually, she found a dental mold that had been done of Grace Doe's teeth and sent that along as well. Also, Lori was working the scientific route as well. There were two biological pieces of evidence that actually were in storage. One was a single hair that had been found on the woman's jacket, and there was also a fingernail. She sent the fingernail to the University of North Texas Health Science Center, and they were actually able to extract mitochondrial DNA from this fingernail. To do some review here, mitochondrial DNA is DNA that is passed from a mother to her children. Both men and women have mitochondrial DNA, but only women are able to pass this on. And so the cool thing is that it creates this like matrilineal line that could be traced back through history. So shout out to all of my fellow U4B1Bs out there. Do you know what you are, Vanessa?
No, I don't. Where would I find this?
On your 23andMe.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. I'll have to go look.
So mitochondrial DNA is great, and it's great to have that information, and it's certainly better than nothing, but often you need something else to kind of compare it to. So say a sibling or a mother, for instance, to compare it to, so they can rule out possibilities.
So you said there was the fingernail, mm-hmm. but what about the hair?
Oh, yeah. The hair is determined to be from someone else.
Okay, so we know the fingernail belongs to this woman, but the hair?
Not hers.
Not.
In 2009, the McDonald Sheriff's Department uploaded a profile for Grace Doe into NAMIS, or the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, and also uploaded her information into CODIS, which is the Combined DNA Index System, which creates a database for DNA information for everyone from convicted offenders to missing persons, and even includes DNA information from unsolved crime scenes. Unfortunately, her DNA was not a match to any DNA in this system, but like at the very least, she was in the systems now.
So if something comes up in the future, would that help?
Right. So if they entered something that matched someplace else, that would help them. And then they finally find out where her remains were. They had been in Colombia. Remember, they were supposed to be analyzed. And they had at some point been sent to the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. It's unclear why they were sent there, but some of her bones had been used as teaching tools in a classroom. Her skull and teeth, though, which had been placed in a secure box, were still in that box when she was relocated.
Is it typical when somebody's still in like an active case to be used as like classroom tools?
Yeah, I'm not sure how common this actually is, but it is important to note that university systems do actually have access to a lot of remains. These bones were mailed to Boone County, and Lori went to go pick them up. They had a CT scan of the skull done so that they could send off more information to Victoria Lywood to do a reconstruction. Not long after, Victoria sent back an image of what Grace Doe might have looked like. So this is a huge step forward for this case because finally they had an image they could share out with people and help garner more interest in the case. And receiving the bones back was another major move forward because they contained the femur and her teeth, which could be used for more extensive DNA testing in the future. And though those were major gains for the investigation, the case was kind of at a standstill again. In 2011, Lori told reporters, "I want to reunite her with her family. It's been 21 years. It's time for her to go home, wherever home is." So from there, through the years, Grace Doe and her case served as an important teaching tool, and students working on her case were able to collect information and do analyses. Anthropology students under Dr. Jennifer Bengston at Southern Missouri State University did record searches and learned about missing persons databases. And students with Dr. Amy Michael, who you might recognize from the Fallline podcast or from Laura Norton's book, Lay Them to Rest, had students working on microscopic analysis at the University of New Hampshire. In September 2020, Othram approached the McDonald Sheriff's Department about working the Grace Doe case. Othram specializes in investigative genetic genealogy or forensic genetic genealogy. They work both unidentified remains cases, unsolved homicides, and they've been working to reduce the amount of unidentified remains in the United States. Now, apparently, Grace Doe's DNA was contaminated by bacteria, but they were able to clean up the results enough to be able to run her DNA through genealogical databases. Now, we say this often, but it bears repeating because it gets so confused for people. These are not consumer databases like 23 and Ancestry, but these are ones like FamilyTree DNA and GEDmatch where you can upload your data. The first results they got back were third cousins, but through their work, they were able to construct a family tree and come back to McDonald County and give them some names to contact. Lieutenant Hall, who had worked Grace Doe's case from the beginning, he contacted a woman they believed was Grace Doe's half-sister. Now, though Grace Doe's siblings' names are publicly available, I'm leaving them out of this podcast for privacy reasons. Grace Doe's potential sister was at work when they called, and she said at first she thought it was a scam of some sort, but she talked to some family members and eventually called back. This woman did have a half-sister who she'd never met and had never been able to locate. She was sent a DNA test, and this would help confirm a relationship between her and Grace Doe.
That's amazing. So
Yeah.
now are we getting there? We're going to find out who she is soon.
Yes.
Okay.
We'll be back in a moment.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
So the results came back on March 29th, 2021, and that was the day that Shauna Beth Garber got her name back and was no longer known as Grace Doe. Shauna was originally from Garnett, Kansas, and was 22 when she was murdered.
Okay, there's going to be some sad stuff ahead. Like now?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Why? Why do we have to have sad stuff?
It's always sad stuff.
Do you have any information about Shauna so we can get to know her a little better?
So that's actually a bit more complicated than you might think. So I'm going to share what has been publicly released about her.
Okay.
And Shauna's story really is one of tragedy. She grew up with two older brothers, one about 11 years older, one roughly 2 years older. Both brothers say that their mother was abusive, particularly to Shauna. And one of the brothers, even now, says that their mother was evil. When the oldest brother was in high school and the other brother was in kindergarten, their mother was in a relationship with a man who would end up being Shauna's half-sister's father.
Okay, the woman we met through DNA.
Yes. One day, while the boys were at school, their mother had gotten into an argument with her partner. Apparently, she wanted his keys so that she could go into town, but he refused. And the two of them got into an argument. In a fit of anger, their mother poured what they said was lighter fluid on Shauna and lit her on fire.
Oh my gosh.
It seems as though both brothers weren't told right away what was going on, but school officials came and told them that they would each be getting on different buses instead of going home that day. All of the children were placed in separate foster homes. Her oldest brother said that after she got out of the hospital, he and Shauna would look forward to seeing each other on Sundays because their foster parents attended the same church. But he thinks that the last time he saw her might have been in 1973. To this day, he says he's not reconciled what happened to her family. He told reporters, "I haven't come to grips with what happened to Shauna in the first place when she was a baby."
So she was a baby when that happened?
She was around 4.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And her other brother says that the last time he saw her was about 1 year after the incident on his 8th birthday. He says he started looking for her when he turned 18, but he couldn't find her. Who he did end up finding, though, is his half-sister. She hadn't even been born yet when the older siblings were taken away from their home, and she really knew little about their family. But once she knew about Shauna, they both started looking for her together. But because they didn't even know if her name had changed, they weren't even certain where to search for her or what name to use for her. And to be clear, there is not a lot of information about Shauna or her life. Though she'd been in foster care, she'd been moved into state care at some point, and her family doesn't even have a picture of her from when she was an adult.
This is incredibly sad.
Yeah.
Did they ever say if the artist's rendering of her was similar to how she would have looked?
I think that they're unsure since they only knew her, the brothers only knew her as like a small child, and her half-sibling never knew her, right? And so though the family has some answers about what happened to Shauna, they don't have all of the answers. And it reminds us of that episode that we did on Marcia King, who was known as Buckskin Girl for like 40 years. Like, identifying them helped, and it helped trace their movements, but maybe not enough to give a clear picture of where they were or when they might have encountered their killers.
Killers? Plural?
Killers, question mark. Plural, okay. But plural. Question. So that really brings us to the next stage of this story, and I debated about whether or not to actually include this because it's still relatively fresh, but I think because this is a direction the investigation into her death went, it's important to include here. So in August of last year, I was scrolling on the dreaded Bird app. I don't even think that you have.
Mm-mm.
No.
Nope. I'm a Twitter quitter.
You were a Twitter quitter.
Mm-hmm.
Back when it was Twitter. I actually haven't posted in forever, but I occasionally scroll. And I was scrolling when I saw Shauna's name pop up on my feed. And it was because Carrie Rawson was posting about her. And I really want to handle this all with delicately as possible because there's a lot of debate in what I'm about to talk about. But I think at the end of the day, it is all just really people who have the best of intentions in getting Shauna's case solved.
Okay.
My guess is, Vanessa, you do not know.
I don't know who
Carrie Rawson,
is. So. Okay. And yeah.
Okay. So Carrie Rawson is an advocate and a writer who's been doing a lot of victim advocate work and a lot of advocacy work for family members of killers. Like, sometimes that we mention often is that when someone is murdered, right, that affects a lot of their family members, but also that killer had family members as well.
Right.
And that is often like a complicated place to be.
We don't really think about them much, do we?
Yeah, like how they are also
impacted. Their life is also quite damaged.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay. And it's important to note, Carrie Rawson is also the daughter of a serial killer. So she's in a unique position to do that kind of work.
I could see that being difficult. She knows from a firsthand standpoint, like, how that feels for someone to put another person's actions kind of on who you are, maybe.
Right. And yeah, so
especially like, being the daughter, right?
Yeah. I mean, I can't even like speak to what her experience is or has been, but processing all of that. But also, she's been such an advocate for other people. And like, so that is why I don't want to misrepresent what she does or what she said. So when possible, I'm just going to use direct quotes from her. And so I'm having to do like a bit of backfilling here to kind of set the stage for why Carrie Rawson is bringing up Shauna Garber's name.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, like, I actually encountered a conundrum that I didn't know how to handle because it's our practice not to mention killers' names here so we can focus on victims. And usually I'll kind of bend the rules when, like, there's a moniker like the media gave them because it kind of just helps the flow of conversation that we're having. So, like, when we did the Kingsbury Wren story or the Lady of the Lake, we talked about the Cleveland Torso murders.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of really hit a snag here because the name Carrie Rawson's father is known by the BTK killer is actually a name he gives himself, which feels like I'm just kind of feeding into the identity that he had. But I'm actually kind of feeling a bit more okay with this because it's not necessarily a name that is well known as I thought. I mean, Vanessa, if you flash back in time.
Do we have to talk about it?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
We talked about this story a few months ago, right? I let mm-hmm. you know we were going to talk about it, and I said BTK, and Vanessa, you thought I meant...
You're going to make me say it?
Yes.
The Bermuda Triangle Killer. I was trying to think of anything that could be, like, those initials that somebody would put, but I was not prepared for what it actually means.
Right.
Which is...
Well, I'm not going to say it.
You're not going to say it?
I think that, no. No, okay. But it's not the Bermuda Triangle killer.
Well, you guys can look it up and find out it's not Bermuda Triangle.
No. Now Vanessa knows.
Yeah. Now I know.
Right. And so we've said it. We've now said it several times. So I'm just going to replace that with pronouns here. So he's just going to be he.
Okay.
So if you are like Vanessa and you don't have a lot of background on this, this man is from Kansas and worked as an ADT security services installer for security alarms. I'm really only being specific about him because I'm returning to those points later. Between 1974 and 1991, he murdered at least 10 people. And because I have said his name or the name he went by enough here, I'm going to name them. The victims include the entire Otero family, which included Joseph and Julia, as well as her children, Joseph and Josephine, Catherine Bright, who was 21, Shirley Relford, who was 25, Nancy Fox, who was 25, Maureen Hedge, who was 53, Vicky Weggerly, who was 28, and Dolores Davis, who was 62. All of those victims were from Wichita, Kansas. Those victims were often found bound, usually using household items like rope or nylon stockings, and the cause of death was strangulation or asphyxiation. This man was arrested in 2005, and throughout the years, he had sent out haunting messages about these crimes. In 2005, he attempted to leave one of those messages in a parking lot, but it was discarded. And so he wrote to police basically asking if it would be better to send his messages via floppy disk. And they sent word through the newspaper that yes, the use of a disk would work. So that's what he did. But the disk includes metadata. And so they were able to trace him and identify him as a suspect.
It's so strange. Like, he's naming himself like a very like over-the-top name. And then he's trying to figure out how to communicate with people better.
Right.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the things about him is that he stalks victims and also potential victims. And he kept this information in notebooks. He also had drawings he made as well as photographs that seemed to be him reenacting the scenes.
Mm-mm. Okay.
Yeah. So the case against him was a really tight case, which is perhaps why it's not surprising that on the day of his actual trial, he just changed his plea to guilty. But there's really sort of this like specter of him that lingers, and there's a lot of unanswered questions about his crimes. Like, if he killed that many people, is it possible that he killed others? Are there more clues in his notebooks or in the images? Which is why when the Osage County Sheriff from Oklahoma is watching an episode of Catching Killers on this man, he decides to revisit some of the cases he has. So what enters the news and when we become aware of him again and why we're sort of having this conversation now is they start looking at the unsolved disappearance of Cynthia Kinney, who was 16 when she went missing from a laundromat in Pawhuska, Oklahoma on June 23rd, 1976. Pawhuska is where Pioneer Lady lives.
Is it?
Yeah.
Huh.
One of the man's fantasies involved laundromats.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, I hate having this conversation.
I don't like this guy.
And he often watched women and girls from outside the laundromats, and he wrote about those fantasies in a book he was working on. And in 1976, there's a journal entry labeled Project, which is what he called people he stalked or murdered. And he called this person Bad Wash Day.
He called it a person that?
It's like part of like his journals are cryptic, and so like he often won't refer to people as names. I'll just kind of give them like titles almost.
Ugh.
Yeah. And so for Cynthia, there's some reason that she's considered a possibility. One, it's in the time frame that he was actively killing people. Two, there's the laundromat situation. Three, the Osage County is about 2 hours away from his home. And four, there's a bank across the road from the laundromat that was under construction and was getting an ADT security system installed. For his part, though, he claims, if you want to believe him at all, is that the laundromat writings were simply fantasies and not something he acted on.
Do we believe him? Why would we believe him?
I have no idea. Right? Mm-hmm. But that brings us to Shauna. The reason she starts being talked about is they're taking this broader look at unsolved cases in this region. And Shauna was found about 3.5 hours from Wichita. And if she was in the Joplin area where they thought she might have been living, that's more like 3 hours away. The other thing is, of course, the bindings that were used on her, as well as death from strangulation.
Right. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, but one thing that doesn't match up is that Shauna was raped, which is not in line with what happened to the other known victims of this man.
So he's a lot of things, but not a rapist.
Definitely his crimes were sexually driven, But he did not rape them.
Ew.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I see why his daughter is, like, trying to help people. Because imagine growing up knowing that these are the things your dad did.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I think a lot of what she says is that he was her dad, and then to find out later that that's what he was doing. Yeah.
Because was he, like, a normal good dad?
I mean, I think, like, it's all very complicated, but, like, right. Yeah, I think...
He just seemed normal, and then this was happening?
Yeah, like, I think this completely took her by surprise, too, right? But because of this investigation, Carrie Rawson makes a statement on August 22nd, 2023. This is where we start publicly hearing about Shauna. And she states, in June 2023, I contacted the McDonald County Sheriff's Office in Missouri to offer my volunteer assistance on the Garber case. I was quickly connected with the Osage County Sheriff's Office, to which I offered the same aid, and was promptly flown to Osage County, Oklahoma, to assist on both cases. I've returned since to the Osage County Sheriff's Office to work in a volunteer capacity as an active agent of law enforcement, assisting on these two cases, including visiting my father twice at the El Dorado Correctional Facility.
Okay. So is visiting him, like, first off, I wasn't even aware that he was alive still, because I guess when we talk about a lot of these cases, these people aren't, they're no longer with us.
Right.
So that's surprising. But then also, was she in the habit of visiting him?
You know, I think she has, from what I can tell, she's always tried to be of service. And in order to actually go and see him, she actually had to have a lot of help removing, like, order of protections, because she had order of protections taken out. So,
okay.
That protected her. So she had to have those lifted in order for her to be able to go.
So it's absolutely not a typical thing she was doing.
No, like, that's why I said, like, you know, the full intent of people really seems to be towards helping solve this case.
Right.
And other cases that might
be imagine, like, how difficult that would have been for her.
Yeah.
God. Yeah. That's dedication.
Mm-hmm. And so part of this is he's been offered immunity in further cases in this tri-state area to try to get him to actually speak. But at this point, it doesn't look like he's been moved to confess either of these cases to investigators or to Carrie. And also, to be clear, there are a lot of people who don't believe he should be considered giving key evidence. That includes other investigative people, other people familiar with the case. There's a lot of conflict back and forth about what's going on here. But, like, I'm just happy that investigators in this area are actually pursuing leads to find and identify Shauna's killer.
So why don't they think he should be considered?
There's, like, some key differences. There's also been some, like, controversial things that have been said in the meantime that I'm not going to necessarily pick apart, but I think it's caused some, like, mixed feelings about this conversation.
Okay. Now, there was another woman that was killed around the same time as Shauna.
Right.
And it was kind of similar but different from Shauna.
Similar but different. So that's Connie Zaleski, mm-hmm. and she was found, she had been sexually assaulted, also strangled, likely with, like, a clothesline or something like that, hadn't been found with her body. And so, yeah, like, in the first few weeks, Connie and Shauna are kind of mentioned in tandem, and they were trying to see if they were connected. But Connie's murder was unsolved until 1999, when police arrested a man in California. This man murdered Connie in Missouri in 1990. He was also responsible for the sexual assaults and murders of Kimberly Miller, who was 15 in 1974. Her body was found in Azusa Canyon, California. And the murder of Deborah Hawk, who was 22 when she was found murdered in Rancho Cucamonga in 1987 in California. When he was taken in, he said that they had taken a monster off the streets. And he also claims to have raped over 100 women.
Isn't it, like, really unsettling when people know they're monsters? Like, yeah. You know this. You know you need to be stopped. But, like, ugh, it's just... But this sounds a little bit more of, like, what happened to Shauna as well, right?
Right. Like, because that's been something, like, I've been wondering as well, right? So given that initial thought that they had. And like they ended up not pursuing that. But like I dived into some research about Connie's case just because I was curious about how that had turned out, which is how I came across this information. I know at the time of his arrest and conviction, investigators had promised that they were looking to see if he could be tied to other assaults and murders, particularly that had been happening in Missouri at that time. But it's not clear at all if they revisited Shauna's case when they were talking about that. Mm. So I don't know.
Right, because the things that happened to Shauna could be like either one in a sense, but given the area and that she was raped.
Yeah.
It looks like this guy.
I mean, I if anyone is listening and can clue me in to see if they pursued this direction in Shauna's case, I would like to know. Because I think, yeah, I mean, I was just really curious because they had talked a lot about it in those like first few articles that were coming out about Shauna when her body was first found.
Mm-hmm.
And so for cases like this, I think we often think that when an unidentified person gets their name back, we kind of throw around the word like closure, like the family will get closure, right? And I think maybe there's like something that does happen, but Shauna's case has come like such a long way, even from the time that I only knew her as Grace Doe, but there's so many unanswered questions about what actually happened to her.
There's really no closure, aside from the fact that her siblings now know that she's no longer with us. There's right. No other, like, who did it? Why? Like, who is she?
Yeah, and, like, what happened to Shauna between childhood and adulthood? So she was right. Murdered when she was 22. Yeah. And, like, who did she encounter? And where was she? And what kind of life did she have? All of those questions that are still circulating.
Do you think anyone's ever going to try to piece that together?
So I think I'm kind of reassured by the fact that, you know, at the very least, her name has entered the conversation. Whether or not she's tied to that first guy or not, it does mean that there's like some movement and interest in her case. And so my hope is that they can move it forward.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, In the Cursed Country, read by Terrell Rothery. Terrell Rothery is a Canadian actor of stage, television, and film. She is best known for her portrayal of Dr. Janet Frazier on Showtime's Stargate SG-1 and her starring role in the Hallmark Channel original series Cedar Cove. Rothery can most recently be seen in Upload and Virgin River. She has been in a number of television movies, Hallmark movies, and mysteries. Terrell is also a certified intuitive coach and clinical hypnotherapist.
In the Cursed Country, unidentified woman discovered December 2nd, 1990, in McDonald County, Missouri. Title from a line by Joy Harjo. Who we are is not tethered cords or the way our skin reflects winter light. We are grace. Because memory is a parachute that falls quickly until it lights with a flame match. Grace, in that the fox knows the way to worry bone, breaking it open to the soft marrow. Grace, in a land that remembers it kneels to yield to coming frost, that preserver of death. Grace, in a woman who never forgets how to carry the weight of another human home again.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.
My name is Bill Huffman, and I am a former Cleveland news producer, and I am now the host of the podcast, Who Killed? I began the show focusing on the unsolved murder of Amy Mihaljevic, and now each week I explore a different case with a focus on some of the victims who don't get the attention they deserve. I have a deep catalog of over 225 episodes, so there is a guarantee there will be something for you. Who Killed is an Evergreen Podcasts, Killer Podcasts, and Slow Burn Media production. Subscribe today wherever you get your favorite shows.